From the campus of the University of Hawaii, this is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Lecture Series Podcast. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at hawaii.edu/CSEAS and at iTunes.
Well, thank you, Professor. First of all, I would like to thank the political science departments and you in particular for approving my trip here before the budget cuts, because your head of department just came and he cannot come to this talk. But this is a very special occasion for me to come to Hawaii, because many people go to Asia and then they go to from New York go to Asia and bypass Hawaii. But what I did was, last week I came from Phnom Penh to New York, flying 24 hours, and then from New York the next day to Hawaii, you know. So if I'm jet-lagged and talk nonsense, you know, you have to forgive me, because I don't know whether I'm jet-lagged from New York or from Phnom Penh, you know. Well, I was very jet-lagged because Phnom Penh is in the middle of Khmer New Year, Chul Chanam Khmer. And in Thailand, I don't know whether there are any Thai students here, and Myanmar and Laos, it's known as Songkran also. So it's this New Year. In Thailand, they throw water at each other. In Phnom Penh, they just drink beer with each other. And thank you for coming, all of you. Let me see. April is always a busy month in Cambodia. Monday, I already mentioned about Khmer New Year, but today especially is a very sad anniversary. 17 April is a very important date in Cambodia, because that's when the Khmer Rouge entered Phnom Penh and started a reign of terror for more than 3 years, killing 1.7 million people, and which lasted until January 7. So before I continue, may I ask the audience to have 1 minute of silence to remember all the victims in Cambodia, not only those who are killed, but those who suffered, and that includes practically everybody. So let's just have 1 minute of silence. Thank you. So I'm glad that the political science told me you have to come 17 April. You know, this is a very special day. Very special, yeah. We have our Cambodian friends here, and all of Cambodians, as I mentioned this morning. Those of you who were here this morning, I hope you don't get bored, because, well, I will change a little bit, you know. It's a very sad occasion, of course. And everyone is involved in Cambodia. Everyone is a victim or a perpetrator. Well, we hope that the perpetrators get tried soon, because it's 30 years until now. But at lunchtime, I talked a lot about this trial, but this is the political science department, so I'm concentrating my talk this afternoon about the political aspects of the Cambodian crisis. Well, we already talked. Thank you for making propaganda for my book. In Barnes & Noble, it's $30 plus tax without signature. So here it's $25 without tax with signature. I will not tell you how much it is in Cambodia, otherwise nobody will buy. But it's pirated copies. You are going to Cambodia this summer, but you can buy it now, you know. The one there is not so good. What lao? So this book is my life history, you know, life history during 5 years in Cambodia. So it is a memoir. But it's a memoir with attitude, as I would call it. Because I wrote this book wearing three pair of lenses. One is an observer on the ground in Cambodia, of course, being there myself for 5 years. 2 years in Siem Reap, the hometown of my friends here, Chowai Kai, Siem Reap. And 3 more years as ambassador in Phnom Penh. So you get 2 books in the price of one, you see. One is about the UNTAC period, and that is an entirely different story than part two, especially from political science. Because what happened in part one, as I will tell in a few minutes, part one, we were supposed to be the government in Cambodia. And part two, of course, I was the ambassador. Cambodia had its own government. When I came to Siem Reap, you know, part one, I came and I arrived with UNTAC is a peacekeeping force with 100 from 100 countries. So I came to the governor's mansion of Siem Reap with troops from Ireland and troops from Bangladesh and so on. And I said, Mr. Nuzam, you know, I am the governor of Siem Reap. You know, he said, no, I am the governor of Siem Reap. So I said, no, I am the governor. So finally, I blinked, and I will tell you from political science standpoint why I was so stupid to blink, you know, because the UN thinks it was the government, but it was not the government. It's all very complicated, and as Barbara Andaya says, provocative. So if you get angry, you just don't walk out, just tell me you don't tell the truth, you know. Okay. So the second part is I was more like a UN Secretary General's representative in Cambodia. So as I said, I wear three pair of lenses. The first part as an observer on the ground. I was in Cambodia. I watched with my own eyes what happened, you know. The second part, I was an official of the United Nations in New York. So I moved from Cambodia back to New York and back to Cambodia, back and forth. And that gives me a perspective and made me angry because of what happened in the General Assembly in New York. So it is an angry book, you know. I hope you like angry books. You already paid, so you cannot. And the third one, I wrote this book at the University, Cornell University, for 3 years. I was there as a visiting scholar. So that way I can relate, you know, these developments on the ground to New York. And then in Cornell, I did the research. For instance, I like to give an example. When I first arrived in Cambodia, it was very, very poor. This was in April 1992. And the Khmer Rouge has been gone since 1979. January 7, 1979, they were actually ousted. So I thought to myself, why is Cambodia still so poor? Well, the answer lies in politics. And then here I moved to New York, because what happened is, so first of all, I will tell you why my book is called Sihanouk, the Khmer Rouge and the United Nations. I hope I don't offend my friends from Cambodia that I consider Sihanouk also part of the problem. Okay, so, Somto? Ot Banha? No Banha. Well, you see, because he says no problem, you know. If I say this about the Thai king, I'll be in jail when I arrive in Bangkok. You know, he's studying, comparing Thailand and Cambodia. And so Sihanouk, the Khmer Rouge, and the United Nations. I think that the interaction between these three, that's why I call it dancing in shadows, prolonged the tragedy and the suffering of Cambodia for a long time. Khmer Rouge, of course, it's obvious, you know, they killed 1.7 million people. But who started this problem? I think it's Sihanouk. And I will tell you in a little bit that the United Nations also contributed. I started by saying that when I came to Cambodia, I saw all this poverty after 13 years from the Khmer Rouge. So, of course, the problem was that when the UN, when the, okay, I'll just start explaining why it was. First of all, so this shadow play of the tragedy of Cambodia occurred during the Cold War. And this is the saying of a professor of history in Cornell. During the Cold War, truth was a tragically relative term. Many Americans were sent to death by the tens of thousands, while Asians, Latin Americans, and Africans were sentenced to death by the millions because of U.S. officials disagree with foreign leaders about what each believed was true. So, of course, Cambodia, there was a killing of 1.7 million people. But in my own country, Indonesia, also, there were 800,000 were killed. In Timor-Leste also, they were killed because of the Cold War. Even Timor-Leste has something to do with the Cold War because the Suharto, with sorry to say, you know, he thinks East Timor is the Fretilin, is communist, and he told the Americans, you know, it's very dangerous to have a beachhead for the communists there in the second part. So he asked President of America, can I invade East Timor, you know? So the president of the U.S. was visiting Indonesia, and he says, do it tomorrow. It's unfortunately, it's the truth, you know? So it is Cold War related, because Fretilin was considered leftist, you know, with the Portuguese Revolution, the Carnation Revolution, and the Fretilin. In fact, there is a link between Fretilin, I don't know whether you have Fretilin or not, but in Cambodia, you see, because the Fretilin leaders were leftist and they went to Cambodia, you know, to learn from the Khmer Rouge, actually. And there was a song in Cambodia, you know, it's an Indonesian communist song, you know, Son Sinamut sang this song. Yeah, he is the most famous singer in Cambodia, but he was killed by the Khmer Rouge. First, he was asked to sing the national anthem of Cambodia, but of the Khmer Rouge, and then they killed him. But he also sang an Indonesian communist song, which was sung by the Indonesian communists before they were killed by Suharto. And now it's a top hit in Phnom Penh. You know, I was amazed to hear that song, because if you play that song in Jakarta, you go to jail. So, as I said, it's very much mired in the Cold War, the Cambodian problem. So, before we arrived, so I was part of this UNTAC. You know UNTAC, right? Yes, and before we arrived, Cambodia was mired in tragic conflict for 20 years. So it was not just the Khmer Rouge. As I already mentioned, when I arrived, they were still very, very poor. Well, this is just a picture of the country. Most of you know this, but it's very interesting. We have Vietnam here and Thailand here. And Cambodia was suffering the most in those days, because Cambodians used to say, you know, we are between the tiger and the crocodile. I hope there are no Thais and Vietnamese here. So let us say why I call this the shadow dance. Sihanouk was crowned king in 1941 by the French. And he is mercurial, shrewd, as well as ruthless. As a neutral king in the Cold War, he battled the Khmer Rouge, a small communist movement headed by Pol Pot and others. So most of you probably know this, but I want to tell you, this is our man Sihanouk. You know, somebody says I look like him, but Kamui, Kamui. No. So there were three stages, as I already said. Number one, the Nixon bombings and overthrow of Sihanouk, 69 to 73. Using Sihanouk's own words, no, Nixon's own words, he bombed the bejesus out of Cambodia. He says, we must use every single means to kill every living thing that walks there. So Cambodia was bombed more than World War II, you see. And it's for the Cambodian people, you know, they see these bombs every day. It's like having September 11 for 3 years, 4 years, nonstop. Of course, they got very angry, and they turned to the Khmer Rouge. They became Khmer Rouge. Well, Bush, of course, bombed Iraq and then brought in Americans. So, of course, Americans start getting killed. At least in Cambodia, it's not that. That was the overthrow of Sihanouk, was the second thing. In March 1970, Sihanouk was overthrown by Lon Nol, General Lon Nol, right wing, and Sihanouk blamed the CIA, you know. CIA killed me. Try to overthrow me. So there's a book called My War with the CIA. I'm sure your library has it. And he accused, so he went to Beijing because he was very angry and asked the Beijing, he embraced the Khmer Rouge. So just a second, he was not the Khmer Rouge first, you know. He was a neutral man, just like Sukarno was not leader of the Indonesian Communist Party. But then he said, you know, to the Khmer Rouge, I now join you to fight the American imperialist, Cakawat Nyom, America. And that is part two. So these two things, the overthrow of Sihanouk and the bombing, made the Khmer Rouge such a big force, angry Khmer Rouge, and they want to change Cambodia. And China, when Sihanouk embraced the Khmer Rouge, China gave unlimited arms to the Khmer Rouge. How long should I talk, Professor?
Just go ahead. We have the room until 4 o'clock.
Oh, yeah.
Probably want to leave a little time at the end for discussion.
Yes, I like to leave some time because it's a monologue. It's not nice. And my talk may anger some people, so when you are angry, either you don't leave the room, just say, you know, you shut up, you know. Now the third one. So what happened in the third one? Okay, so there is Nixon bombings, two, the Khmer Rouge, and the third one is the travesty of justice. So let's take one by one. I told you already that these two actions actually made the Khmer Rouge into such a big movement that was able to overthrow Lon Nol in Cambodia. The bombing of Nixon, of Cambodia by Nixon, and the overthrow of Sihanouk, because he embraced the Khmer Rouge, Khieu Samphan, because of that. Now, I already said, but here I will tell you, 2.7 million tons of bombs, more than what was dropped in World War II. So the killing started before Khmer Rouge, you know. First, this was done by Nixon. In fact, Noam Chomsky, you know, the leftist writer, recently says, who should be in the Khmer Rouge trial? It should be Nixon. Of course, Nixon is dead. And then Kissinger should be tried. But Kissinger is now the advisor of Obama, you see. So. And the third one, of course, Sihanouk is still there. So some people say that Sihanouk should be tried also. This young fellow is Khieu Samphan, who is the president of Khmer Rouge. Now he is one on trial, you know, in Phnom Penh. 30 years delayed at the trial. So I already mentioned this, that Sihanouk was. And then, of course, the second stage is the Khmer Rouge itself. Well, everyone here in the room knows what happened, you know. And 1.7 million, everyone probably has seen the movie Killing Field, Well, so far, you know, you still think, why should I buy Benny's book? All this can be read in other books and the Killing Fields, but I'll tell you why you should still buy my book. Now, here comes the crucial point. Finally, the Khmer Rouge period was ended, because the Vietnamese army liberated Cambodia from Khmer Rouge yoke on 7 January 1979, sending them to the Thai border. So here was the Khmer Rouge who killed 1.7 million people. He was ousted by the Thai army and a rebel army of led by Hun Sen, Hang Samrin, and Chia Sim, and they established the People's Republic of Cambodia in Cambodia. So they ousted the Khmer Rouge. But what happened? Now here are the three leaders of Cambodia there and in January 79. The reason why I showed this picture is, you guessed it, they are still there now, you know. They are still the leaders of Cambodia and much more powerful than ever. And this is amazing because in January 1979, if you look at New York, you know, what happened in New York, and as I said, my second pair of lenses was I was in New York. The General Assembly, the UN General Assembly, rather than putting the KR leaders on trial, like the German leaders at the end of World War II, the United Nations, spearheaded by the US and China, recognized by a majority vote the genocidal Khmer Rouge as the government of Cambodia, instead of the People's Republic of Cambodia, the de facto government of Cambodia. This is, to me, a travesty of justice, you see, because they condemned Vietnamese invasion. They say you never should invade another country. But of course, Vietnam stopped the killing. If there was not no invasion, maybe we have no Cambodians now. Because Pol Pot was so crazy, he starts killing his own people. First he killed the right, the rich people. Then he killed everybody. He killed the people from eastern Cambodia, because he says they are Cambodian bodies with Vietnamese minds. Because he says we must kill the Vietnamese. So the Vietnamese invaded and got rid of this Pol Pot regime. But the UN in New York didn't want anything to do with that. They don't like Hun Sen, another Vietnamese puppet, they call it, as the head of another country. First they lost Vietnam, you see, the US in 75. So they don't want this, this Hun Sen fellow to be there. So they did not recognize. And then I came back to the first question that I asked. When I arrived in Cambodia, why are they so poor? Because not only were they not recognized, the People's Republic of Cambodia, but they were denied foreign aid. So after three years of hunger under the Khmer Rouge, instead of getting liberated, because they were liberated by another communist, you know, the Vietnam, and the UN says in New York, no aid for Cambodia, because they are not the legitimate government. The legitimate government is the Khmer Rouge. You know, it's asking Hitler to represent Germany. Now, this kind of things you find in other books too, but very often this is hidden, you know. Last week I had an article about the Khmer Rouge trial, and they put this between brackets. The UN did not recognize the Khmer Rouge. Now, so of course now I want to stop, since this is political science and international relations is very important aspect. I want to ask, how can the UN be like that? Who is the UN? You know, who is the United Nations? The United Nations is not a world government. The United Nations is as good and as bad as the individual governments that are composed in the United States, in the United Nations. There are two major bodies there. There's the Security Council, dominated by 5 veto-wielding powers. 15 members in the Security Council, but 5 countries holds all the power. They have veto power. One is the USA, 2 is the People's Republic of China, 3 is the Soviet Union, now it's called Russia, because they are emasculated, and 4 is Britain, and 5 is France. These were the victors of World War II, which is long over, but they are still dominating the UN. You know, so here you have this New York completely dominated by these 5. So first, of course, they want to have a resolution condemning the Vietnamese invasion in Cambodia, but Russia vetoed that. So instead, they went to the General Assembly, and it is the General Assembly which has 193 member states now that voted to have the Khmer Rouge continuing this as the government of Cambodia. You know, I was in New York. Every day I worked for the UN, and every day I see the Khmer Rouge flag there flying. Even after they were defeated, if I were a Cambodian, I would cry there. Why is the Khmer Rouge, after having killed 2 million people or 1.7 million, allowed to have their flag continues? But that's the vagaries of politics. On the other hand, the People's Republic of Cambodia, which at that time controlled Cambodia physically, de facto, was denied aid. So that explains the question I asked in the beginning. When I arrived in Phnom Penh, they are very, very poor. The only country that was allowed to give aid to Cambodia is the Soviet Union, but they are not a very rich country, $100 million a year. So the Cambodian people were very, very poor, even 11 years after the Khmer Rouge was ousted. This, as I said, continued for 11 years. So for 11 years, the Cambodian, the government was the Khmer Rouge government. But in order to sort of fudge this, you know, they created 2 more factions. One is Phun Chin Pek, which is the royalist faction, and the other is KPNLF. It's a pro-American faction. So they had now 4 factions. Khmer Rouge, Phun Chin Pek, and KPNLF, they form a coalition. And they are recognized by the UN. The 4th one, PRK, People's Republic of Cambodia, was not recognized by the UN. And of course, this prolonged the suffering of the Cambodian people, as I said, because they were denied foreign aid. Nobody can give them foreign aid. Finally, in October 23, 1991, the Paris Peace Accord, which created the United Nations UNTA, and that was in October. But here is where my book starts being different from other books. I think the Paris Peace Agreement itself was flawed. You see, because other book will say, well, the UN brought peace in Cambodia. Even the Cambodians were hailing us as peace. You know, in Siem Reap, I was treated to tea everywhere. Everyone was poor, but they can give me tea and cookies everywhere because I brought peace to Cambodia. But why was it flawed? Because, number one, this 11 years of recognizing the Khmer Rouge continued in the Paris Agreement. In the Paris Agreement, the Khmer Rouge was treated as an equal partner. Because again, you know, their friends in New York, China especially, and the US, say the Paris Agreement is an agreement of 4 factions. The Khmer Rouge, Hun Sen, Phun Chin Pek, that's the King's Party, and the KPNLF. So we were told, we UNTA, that all 4 should be treated equal, that you cannot treat the Khmer Rouge as an enemy. So we were, you know, my hands were tied as being governor of UNTAC in Siem Reap. We are not allowed to treat them as Khmer Rouge. So they continue to flourish rather than be tried in a court. So This to me is another travesty of justice. Because here are the people who killed 2 million people and they were treated like equal. Of course, the problem is, it's like a mental patient, this Khmer Rouge, you know. The UN believed its own lies for 11 years. So they say, Khmer Rouge is a good boy, you know. He is no more crazy, you know. Let's release him. But of course, they are still crazy. Because they continue to kill under UNTAC. I was almost killed, you know. There's a picture of me having a threat from the Khmer Rouge. They attacked me in Siem Reap. I was the governor there. 800 Khmer Rouge came to attack Siem Reap. So again, you know, I mean, this is the funny thing is that the UN, they believe their own lie, that Khmer Rouge is a good guy. And so, in the UN, believe their own lie for 11 years. And Cambodia, once again, has to suffer the consequences of this ostrich policy. For instance, the bamboo pole incident. The Khmer Rouge has its own territories in Cambodia. One is called Pai Len. Pai Len is a very rich gem mining area. We discussed that in the morning about the gem mining. And this bamboo pole incident is that my boss, the big boss of UNTAC, Akashi is his name, Japanese, you know, he was trying to enter the Khmer Rouge territory. And he was stopped by a bamboo pole by a young Khmer Rouge soldier without weapons. So here is the end of the UN, you know. He blinked, you know. I blinked in Siem Reap and Akashi blinked in Pai Len. Because we are supposed, if they are our equal partner, we are supposed to enter their territory. But they refused to let us go into their territory by the bamboo pole incident. Another thing is my province, you know, as I said, I am the governor of Siem Reap. At least I'm but the only one who knows is me, you know, nobody else knows that I'm the governor. But we were attacked by Khmer Rouge. First, there was 3 girls, they were sleeping in a tent because they are Cambodian girls. And we were attacked by Khmer Rouge and they killed 2 because they shot in the tent from left and right. And the girl in the middle did not die, but she suffered such trauma because, you know, her next door. So why did they attack us? So in other words, the Khmer Rouge was treated with a velvet glove in New York, but they still attack us because they say these girls are sleeping with UNTAC police, you know. So they are very moralistic. They like to be moralized, you know. They say these girls are bad. The another one is Angkor Chum. You know the Angkor Chum. This is the another district in my province of Siem Reap. This is very interesting. Angkor Chum is always attacked by Khmer Rouge because they are very close by. And it is about 60 miles from where I was, the capital of Siem Reap. 60 miles you get is the, in Hawaii maybe you are in sea already, but anyway, this 60 miles and I was news, you know, I get my handy talkie. There were no cell phones in those days yet, but the handy talkie. And anyway, I talked to my soldiers in Angkor Chum. They said they are being attacked by Khmer Rouge. So I wanted to withdraw the UN volunteers from Scandinavia because they were exposed there. But they refused to be withdrawn. This girl says, if the Bangladeshi soldiers are continuing there, we will also stay put there. So I was scared the whole night, you know, because in the morning I called the girls, you know, with my handy talkie and they did not reply. So I thought if they died, it's on my conscience. But it turns out they did not die. They said later, oh, we were fast asleep, you know, when you called. So it's interesting that the Khmer Rouge was moralizing. These 2 girls from Scandinavia, they live unprotected. But the Khmer Rouge was watching, they are helping Cambodia, you see. And they didn't touch them. But the police, you know, the police are the biggest, moralistically the biggest, all their houses were ransacked by the Khmer Rouge, because the police are very highly paid UN people, and they always try to bring videos from Thailand, you know, to seduce the girls and so on. So the Khmer Rouge became the moral authority there. Now, then came the big attack on me, on Siem Reap City. And so Akashi, the head of the UN in Phnom Penh, asked Hun Sen. He says, you know, you have to protect this Widiono, you know, because he is being attacked by Khmer Rouge. So Hun Sen says, why me? You know, I am supposed to be in a ceasefire, you know. I am not there to protect you. So Akashi says, well, never mind, you know, I will ask you, please protect. So my point is, I mentioned this at lunchtime, you know, who is in charge of security? We had 15,000 soldiers, the UNTAK, from many battalions, you know, from Uruguay. In Ratanakiri, there was Uruguay, so all the children speak Uruguayan, you know, and Indonesian battalions and so on. But we are not in charge of security. We were in charge of demobilizing the soldiers. Remember, Khmer Rouge are a good boy, you know, so they will all be demobilized. How can you demobilize Khmer Rouge when you are not even allowed into their territory? So this Hun Sen troops also says, if you cannot demobilize the Khmer Rouge, why should I be demobilized? You want to kill me by the Khmer Rouge? So this is the dilemma, you know. I'm telling you, my book, I think even in Timor-Leste, we have this problem, you know. Always, the UN is supposed to be neutral, but because of this lie that the Khmer Rouge are good guys, we try to demobilize, we cannot even enter their territory. So that's why I said these are examples of the mental patient, meaning Khmer Rouge is still a mental patient. So the second flaw of the Paris agreements was, as I mentioned earlier, that there were actually three governments in Cambodia. Well, four and five, but the main ones are three. One is the UN. Why is the UN the government? Because there were two governments in Cambodia, as I said. One is the People's Republic of Cambodia, headed by Hun Sen, recognized by the Soviet Union and its allies, plus India. The two is the Khmer Rouge government, recognized by the US of our countries, China, and the rest of the West. So in order to solve this problem, they say we must make the UN the government. That's a great idea from the Australian Garrett Evans, who is the foreign minister of Australia. It's a great idea, but that's why I said it's a flaw, because how can I be the governor of Siem Reap when Siem Reap has its own government for 11 years? Just because the UN says, I don't see you, Hun Sen, you are not there, doesn't mean that he doesn't exist, you see. So this is the crazy thing, you know. And then there is the Supreme National Council, because the UN is not allowed to govern a country. Well, in Timor-Leste, you know, for a while they were also the government, because Indonesia, you know, created so much havoc. In Timor-Leste and in Kosovo, the UN was the government. But in Cambodia, we became the government, but we cannot be it. So we have to get the authority from a Cambodian authority, and this is called the Supreme National Council. This is headed by none other than our friend Sihanouk, you know. Sihanouk is king, prince, government, head of SNC, filmmaker. He sings, he dances, everything. He is, right? He is very, and he always comes to New York to campaign for the Khmer Rouge, you see, because he tells the General Assembly, don't vote for this Hun Sen, you know. So he has these parties in New York with singing and dancing and so on. It all paid by Singapore, I think, but maybe the U.S. the U.S. behind Singapore. Now, I was once so drunk, I was singing also, and he got so mad. because he let us dance, but he should be the only one singing, you know. So Sihanouk is someone, I know him very well, you know, quite a character. I have another incident. I'm supposed to send these cables to New York through, those times there was no email, crypto fax, fax machine, you know, but my fax machine was crypto. That means it's how do you call it, coded so that people cannot read it. That's what I thought, you know, but every time I write something about Sihanouk, every time he meets me, he says, I think he knows what I wrote in those faxes. He and the French have the best intelligence, you know. They all know. When I was later ambassador to the UN in Cambodia, one of my officers was a French, Gourmelong was his name. It's all in my book, you know. And Gourmelong is very good, you know. He tells me, oh, the French have this intelligence that Hun Sen is really this and that. And Hun Sen joined the Khmer Rouge before he, etc. So I was so happy to him. But later I found out, then he took my secrets and gave it to the French, you know. Well, it's interesting, you know, because I am here an economist in New York, but in Cambodia I became a politician and intelligence officer and almost get killed also. Now I said there were three governments. The Hun Sen government is the real government for 11 years, you see. He is really the one governing the country. So the UN derived its authority from the Supreme National Council. None of them have power, you know, because the Supreme National Council consists of the king and the four factions, but has completely powerless. But the real power is Hun Sen. So that's why I say, you know, I said, I'm the governor. And the real governor, you know, Nui Sam, you know, Nui Sam, he says, no, I'm the governor, so I just gave up. So that's the second flaw of the UN. Well, we did something good, you know. Otherwise, I lose my job if I say the UN was a failure. Well, we did the elections. And everyone said, you know, Botsanam was very successful. 90% of the people voted. It's a very interesting sight, you know. You see, grandmothers, it's a big festival. They have no transport, you know, so they walk for miles. Grandmother, the whole family with children and picnic because they cannot afford to eat in restaurants. So they come and picnic the whole day and then they elect. They were so happy. This guy here, you know, it shows he has an UNTAC ID card. Because we spend $1.7 billion UNTAC. In those days, that's a lot of money, you know. Now, with the bailouts of $80 billion to AIG and $100 billion this and that. But 1.7 for us is a lot of money. And for Cambodia, as I said, when we arrived there, there was not a single car. Well, there were Russian trucks. Russian-made trucks. So we had this 12,000 shiny four-wheelers. You know, they are Toyota four-wheelers, you know. So for the Cambodians, what is this? You know, UNTAC comes here with this 12,000 four-wheelers, very expensive, and they have never seen a car, you know. And a lot of them were stolen, of course, you know, because they had 300 generals there at that time. Every faction has a general. Hun Sen Pek, with the smallest army, has the most generals. You know. And they also stole my vehicles. Every day, my staff says, oh, your vehicle is gone again. Because, and then they paint it and repaint it. And in East Timor, the same thing. Sanana Gusmao says, you know, this is the army of white emperor, you know, conquerors, he called it, you know, the army of the white vehicles. Well, just to give you an aside, now, as Alvin knows, in Phnom Penh they have more Lexus than in New York. You know. Everyone drives a Lexus. I don't know where they got the Lexus. From the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. This, of course, until now I was still driving this. This is the safest vehicle in Phnom Penh, you know. And these are the Untak cars. But this man was very happy because now suddenly he is a human being again. He get this ID card from Untak, laminated, you know. As I said, we spend $1.7 billion. We import everything from paper clips to helicopters. One helicopter can carry 300 people. We have it's made in Russia, all these helicopters. Now here comes Sihanu and me. But the Khmer Rouge continues to be a problem because, as I said, it's a flaw in the agreement. We are supposed to treat the Khmer Rouge as equals, you know, all nice boys, you know. So of course, when Untak left, they were intact, you know. They still control Pai Lin, they still control An Long Weng, that is a sub-province of Siem Reap, where is my province, you know. So when I arrived there in, as I said, Cambodia was very poor, the Khmer Rouge was attacking again. So when I presented my papers, credentials to the king, Sihanouk, he was happy. He was explaining to me, "Excellency, look at this, the Khmer Rouge will control this, you know, the whole crescent. So we will have two Cambodians, you know, one Khmer Rouge and the other by the two prime ministers." So then comes my third lens. When I was at Cornell University, I start looking for explanations. Well, he has always wanted to be the king or the president of an independent but prosperous Cambodia. And this dream was never come through, you know. He became king in 1541. In 1955, he abdicated in favor of his father because he doesn't want to be king anymore. Let my papa be king, you know, so I can be the prince, but I will be head of state. But here now, the constitution says the king reigns but does not rule. So again, he is unhappy, you know, because those two prime ministers, there were two prime ministers there. I forgot to tell you that. The refusal to participate is a blessing in disguise. Just a final point on this part, that the Khmer Rouge refused to participate in the election. And to me, that's a blessing in disguise. Remember, they say Khmer Rouge is a good guy, you know. Now, if they were really good guys and participate in the election, we would have Pol Pot as a minister of interior. So I call it a blessing in disguise because they refuse to be crazy. They continue to be crazy, you know, and they don't want to participate in the elections. And that's a blessing in disguise. That's also new in my book. Other books don't have that. So the Crescent Khmer Rouge government, that's what the king says, you know. So there I realize that he is unhappy. He is a movie maker also. As I said, he is a singer, a dancer, a movie maker. One of his movies is called Ambition Turned to Ashes. You know, it's like a life history. His ambition is to be king of a powerful Cambodia, but he cannot fulfill this dream. And so that's chapter 9 of my book, you see. Now, what we had instead was a government of two prime ministers with equal power. Now, you as political scientists, you know, how can you have a country with two prime ministers of equal power? So why did this happen? Because the election was won by Hun Sen Pak, that's the king's party. And Hun Sen's party was very angry, you know. This Untak, he said, we are helping Hun Sen Pak to win the elections. So he rebelled. Well, he says he didn't rebel, but his party rebelled. Anyway, the king then says, "Okay, children," he calls everyone his children, "two of you can be prime minister." Now, these are the two, you know. Okay, who is not Cambodian? Tell me which one is Hun Sen. Yeah.
One on the left and then the one on the right is Brenner.
How do you know?
Because I was doing Cambodian lessons about
No, I want you to see the body language. You see, because it's very interesting. When I presented my credential to these two, you know, Ranarit was prime minister number one because he won the election, and Hun Sen number two. So Ranarit was talking, blah, 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 blah. And Hun Sen was quiet like that. But at the end, you know, Ranarit asked him, do you have something to say, Hun Sen? And he says, yes. And he says two sentences in answer to my request. So he was listening to me. And that's the story of my part two. You know, everyone says I'm a supporter of Hun Sen, but I'm not the only one. You see, during the second part, Hun Sen is the communist, don't forget, you know. But he delivers. Number one, all the businessmen went to Hun Sen rather than to Ranarit. Because Ranarit, you know, promised the moon, you know, and then he doesn't deliver. But Hun Sen delivers. So these businessmen all prefer to go to the communists, you see. And then the foreign aid people, even the Western ambassadors, they all prefer to go to get things done if you talk to Hun Sen. Because Ranarit is a playboy. But the main thing is also that Hun Sen was in power for 11 years, don't forget. You know, Ranarit came from abroad, he won the election, but he had nobody. He had nobody. Well, he had a handful of people. There's a taxi driver from New Zealand, Weng Sirivut, he became minister of tourism, you see. Because Ranarit had to share the government. So he got half the ministries and Hun Sen got the other half. There is a hamburger cook from New York, Yu Hok Kree, he became minister of interior. There was Po Sutirak, you know, from Seattle, he became minister of industry because he works in a Boeing factory. There is Ung Huat, you know, who is Ung Huat from Australia. And he became communications because he works in a post office, I think. But, you know, that's not the only thing. Ranarit has nothing, you see. The whole structure was Hun Sen. So I would say, if I were Ranarit, it would be like me, you know, when I said, I'm the governor of Siem Reap, and the real governor said, no, you know. So Ranarit would say, you know, I am the president or prime minister, but he cannot control. So two things. One is, the whole machinery was controlled by Hun Sen. And secondly, he is, by nature, a frivolous chap, you know. So what I was trying to say, if Hun Sen was head of Hun Sin Pek, Ranarit was the communist, things might have been different. But here I'd ask you as political scientists when we talk to, or even now, or later when we have the question and answer, what do you do, you see? The people in New York says, Ranarit won the election. So Hun Sin Pek, that's the King's Party, should govern the country. But Hun Sen was governing the country for 11 years, unrecognized by the UN. So what do you do in such a situation? You know? The people in New York says, yeah, give Ranarit, it should have been not two prime ministers, just one Ranarit. But I can just tell you, you know, what would happen if this would have been the case. As I said, it's doomed from the word go. And so my second part is the fascinating story of the interplay between Hun Sen, Ranarit, and the king. You know, the king, as I said, wanted to have full power. He was happy, you know, the Khmer Rouge, this and that. And then he also was happy that the Khmer Rouge, because then he can say, you see, Hun Sen and Ranarit, you are no good. You see, the Khmer Rouge is very good. So now I should be the king again. You know, I should be the head of state. So he called a newspaper man called Nate Thayer, American newspaper man, you know. And Nate Thayer, he said, come here to Beijing. The king, most of the time when he is angry at Hun Sen, he lives in Beijing or Pyongyang. You know, these are two favorite cities. I can understand Beijing, but I don't know. Pyongyang, you know. Well, they have the best Korean food. Actually, they have the only foreign investment in the world, Pyongyang. They have Korean restaurants in Siem Reap and in Phnom Penh. But anyway, so the king is always there. He called this journalist, and he wrote, he is in the Far Eastern Economic Review, he wrote an article, you know, saying that I want to be the head of state again, and there will be four prime ministers, Hun Sen, Ranarit, the Khmer Rouge, and number four is Sam Rainsy, that's a maverick guy. Well, of course, he says in that interview, you know, Hun Sen will be red in the face if he reads this. Ranarit is my son, he will agree. You know. And sure enough, Hun Sen was red in the face, you know, so he wrote a very angry letter to the king, you know, that's unconstitutional, you know. How can you want to take power again and this and that? So that's, I call it in my book, the war in the pen. So the king says, okay, I will not do that. But then he created a man, well, he has a magazine called Bulletin Mensual de Documentation. And in that bulletin, there's a man called Ruamrit. Ruamrit is the same age as the king, and he lives in the Pyrenees, you know. And he talks like the king, and he always write to the king, you know, dear sire, this and that, this Hun Sen is a son of a bitch, and so on. So Hun Sen said, who is this Ranarit? I want his address. But of course, Ruamrit doesn't exist, actually. The king created it. So this is Cambodia, you know, it's a bizarre thing. Sometimes these wars are fought in the magazines. Well, Hun Sen has his newspapers who are pro Hun Sen, you know, and they can attack the king because they don't attack directly. You know, we Asian people, we don't attack directly. So they use a non-existent Ruamrit. And then he created other personalities that do not agree with him. And then they start fighting each other. You know, Ruamrit start fighting. Oh, it's a joke, and I accept that it's so tragic. You know, a lot of people die because of these crazy situations. Well, then in 1997, and Hun Sen emerges as the strong man, and Hun Sen Peck reduced to irrelevance in Cambodia today. Now, how this happened is still a controversy, you know. Most of the Western journalists say Hun Sen staged a coup d'etat. This is July 5 and 6, 1997. But actually, there was a battle of power, of strength, between Ranarit and Hun Sen. You know, as I said, Ranarit was also prime minister, but he had a very small army. You know, Hun Sen has the big army. And so you, again, as political scientists, you see, here is the Hun Sen Peck who won the elections. But so his army was integrated into the army of Hun Sen and became the Cambodian army. But of course, you can identify which one is the Ranarit unit, and it's very small, but he has a lot of generals, this, because General Long Soo Piep, you know, that is Hun Sen general, you know, from Siem Reap, my drinking buddy, but unfortunately, he passed away from drinking too much whiskey, you know. But Long Soo Piep came once from a meeting with Hun Sen Peck, you know, and told me, oh, they have so many generals. He was alone, you know, and suddenly Hun Sen Peck, the other side is all generals, you know. At the end, they had 300 generals or more in Cambodia, and they have a salary of $40 or something. So they all own, they all open casinos, and at one point I counted 30 casinos in Phnom Penh. And then Yu Hok Ri, the Minister of Interior, want to close down the casinos. And he had to use, you know, machine guns and so on, because all these casinos were protected by machine guns, you know, bodyguards and AK-47. So it is still a conflict country, you know, post-conflict country. Now he became very, very strong, this Hun Sen. And as I said, when I was there, in 1996, 97, from 94 to 97, I was there, that's part two of my book. They were trying to reach parity. Ranarit says, you know, I don't want to be a puppet prime minister, and my ministers don't want to be puppet ministers, and the governors don't want to be puppet governors, because Nuosam was replaced, became number two in Siem Reap, you know. Number one was General Tung Chai, because as I said, the governorships were divided, divided into two. Half is Hun Sen and half is Ranarit. So like this province of Siem Reap, I mentioned because they are from Siem Reap, you know. So I was your governor. Oh, you don't know it, but I was your governor. You know, eh? Chawai Kai Siem Reap. But this Tuong Chai became from Ranarit side, became the governor, and the real governor, the one who says to me, I'm the governor, became number two. But Nua Sam. But number one cannot govern, you know, because he is a Phun Sin Pek, he has nobody. And so Ranarit says, I don't want Nua Sam Tuong Chai to be puppet governor. We must be a real governor. So he says, Hun Sen has a big army, I want to strengthen my army, he says. Well, Hun Sen, he was saying that in a secret congress, you know, only Phun Sin Pek invited members in Sihanoukville, that's a nice beach area. Secret, of course, in Cambodia there are no secrets, you know. Everybody, everywhere you find listening. So in no time Hun Sen knows that Ranarit wants to have military balance. So where does he get the troops for the balance? You guessed it. The Khmer Rouge, you see, because they are the best fighters, you see. So they became very suspicious. They start competing with each other for the Khmer Rouge. Now, 1996, the Khmer Rouge General Ieng Sary, who is now in jail and being tried in Phnom Penh, Ieng Sary was the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Khmer Rouge, you know. Quite a sophisticated man. He was in Bangkok, you know, at the Oriental Hotel, and he is the only one who refused the champagne because he says this is a bad year, you know. And this is the Khmer Rouge. And so anyway, so this is Ieng Sary, you know. So that is, let me see. That is the oh yeah. Yeah, so that I think I like to give more chance to discussion, Professor. Yeah, can I? Maybe we can. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
But from the regional point of view, what is the problem with the ASEAN? I mean, it happened in the front of the other countries like Indonesia, Taiwan, and they could make any change within the UN. Why didn't they?
Okay, very good question. Well, as I said before, the UN is controlled by five powers. You know. China, used to be Taiwan, but now it's China, you know. When I first joined the UN, it was Taiwan. China, Russia, used to be Soviet Union. US is still US, you know. France is still France, and England. So ASEAN is very small in the UN, you know. It cannot wield this influence. These five are like dictators. Because they have veto power, they can veto everything. And also, yes, you see, and they have veto even over the Secretary General. The Secretary General is selected by these five. The rest have to just follow. So ASEAN cannot do much. Now, in the case of Cambodia, ASEAN actually sided with the US very much. Because Singapore and Thailand, you know, Singapore was allied to the U.S. very much, and Thailand. But Ali Alatas tried to be neutral, and our ambassador in Bangkok is Hasnan Habib, you know. Ali Alatas, by the way, just passed away, and he wrote a very nice thing about my book, another reason why you should buy my book. But, yeah, so Ali Alatas did play a role in the Paris Agreement, because there were two chairmen, you see, co-chairmen, Indonesia and France, the co-chairman of the Paris peace talks. Why? Because Indonesia played a big role in the reconciliation of Cambodia. because Indonesia had an embassy in Hanoi, you see, the Vietnam, and also, so we had this Jakarta informal talks. That's the start where Hun Sen and the Khmer Rouge came together, and they called it a cocktail party, you know, very, because you know round table means nobody is the boss. But cocktail party is even more than that. You don't even have to talk to the fellow, you know. So the Khmer Rouge was drinking here, and Hun Sen drink there, you know. So Indonesia had this cocktail party called Jakarta Informal Meetings. And that's the first time that Hun Sen met the Khmer Rouge in Jakarta. So that's where Indonesia got the role of mediating. So Indonesia did play a role, but to change the UN, no way, you see. The UN is controlled by these five. These five powers were the victors of World War II. But World War II was 60 years ago, or how many years? I forgot now, 1945, 54 years ago, 64 or whatever. So why the UN should be reformed, you know? These five, the Security Council should be reformed. Japan, you know, is a very rich country now. It's the biggest contributor to the UN after the US. Why is Japan not a member? Germany is a very big contributor because these five are very clever, you know. It's like a club and nobody can enter the club. And also, the countries cannot agree because the developing countries, poor countries like us, you know, I'm still Indonesian, you know, but we cannot agree who should represent Asia, for instance. India always want to be number one, you know. But of course, Pakistan says, oh, no way, no India. Brazil want to be South America, but all the Spanish countries say, no way. So these five are laughing, you know, let them fight all the time, you know. So in the meantime, they continue to be the biggest, the continue to dominate the UN. Now, for instance, I keep saying this is dominated by the Cold War, the Cambodian suffering. Cambodia killed 2 million people because of the Cold War. But now there's no more Cold War, but still there is division. Take Sudan, you see. Sudan is, the president is now actually already indicted by the International Criminal Court, of which East Timor-Leste is a member, as well as Cambodia. The US is not a member, because Timor-Leste, from the beginning, being a suffering country, also joined the ICC. Anyway, ICC says the president of Sudan is condemned. But the UN cannot do anything, because the Security Council, China and Russia, although they are no longer Cold War, they don't want the US to be the dominating power, you know. So that's the problem. Yes, please.
Thank you, Eminent Professor, for a very insightful presentation. Before question, I have some comments. As a younger generation of Cambodia, the debate about Khmer Rouge and the Vietnamese invasion, it is nonsense for me now.
Yeah.
Because it is tragedy and it is foreign invasion. These two things are really, really critical in Cambodian politics, even though nowadays. And second thing is, I see that Paris Peace Agreement is the best one in Cambodian history. If we try to think about it, the day of today, April 17, that the Khmer Rouge came to power, and the day that Vietnam invaded Cambodia, January 7, 1979, and October 23, 1991. So all those days are divisive days. But the agreement of Paris Peace Agreement, it is the reconciliation day that all Cambodian political parties come together and work together. And especially we started with democratic election that's sponsored by the international country and community. So even though it was not successful, but I think it is the cement that can pave a concrete foundation for Cambodia to develop democratic country, democratic future. And so I think Paris Peace Agreement, it is the best day for Cambodia. And Cambodian government should recognize this day, and we should celebrate every year. But now they are not. an easy one issue, a controversial issue about the day. And secondly is, or thirdly, the last one is the tribunal. The tribunal that is ongoing now, I think it is very important for Cambodian history. And even though it is not just what we expect, but I'm thinking that we should not assign any blame on each other, and we should not point the finger. Like Noam Chomsky, he tried to point out that Nixon or Kissinger should be fired about the bombing. And some Cambodians point out that China and Vietnam should also fire. And pointing finger at each other, even though inside the government, even though concerned Kim Chun or Kim Sin themselves, they are the former Khmer Rouge members. Even though Kim Sin is the leading person. But for me, I think they should stop pointing finger at each other. Focus on the trial. If the judge wants to extend more members to be tried, I think they should go on that. It's not a war, it's not a civil war again, because we want justice and we want the court to be a role model for Cambodian judicial reform and court system. So this trial is really significant for Cambodian future. And my question is that I would like to ask is about the future of Cambodia. What do you see that the next election, because this election, the government led by Hun Sen can control all 90 seats, and opposition party like Somerville only supplement only 2 seats than last mandate. So the next election, what do you see about the political change? Because even though inside the CPP they have many competitor also that I see. That it kind of fragile inside. This is not a stable outside, inside, so I wanted to elaborate on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy that not just for your question, but for your remarks. I'm so happy for several reasons that the new Cambodia, you know, is emerging. I mentioned, I think, at lunchtime that the Cambodian pyramid, the population composition of Cambodia is like this. You know, Thailand is like this, fat in the middle. But Cambodia is this. I don't know, Hawaii may be like this, too many old people. I see all old people in the bus, you know. But even on the beach, I see old people. But Cambodia is like this. And what I'm seeing happy, you know, people like him will be the future leaders of Cambodia. Because when I first came, actually, I don't want to elaborate too much on the trial because I spent 1.5 hours at lunchtime, but it's very important what you said. When I was there, of course, because of this, the Khmer Rouge has killed a lot of the intellectual. It's not only this, but the old people who are left, their lack of intellectual. But I am so happy that this part, and you know, guys like you, are, you know, the new intelligentsia. Now, about the Paris Agreement. Yes, you are not the only one who criticized me for that. Actually, I was in Cambodia. I met a very intelligent graduate student from Leeds. Yes, you are right. There is flaws in the Paris Agreement, you know. Khmer Rouge was recognized, but it's the best thing because if we didn't have that, we still would probably be fighting each other. So I'm very, very happy about that, that you are there, you know, and I think Hawaii is lucky, you know, to also have people like this, because I see many of them. Alvin, who was in Cambodia, see also the new generation is no more, you know, devoid of, during the Khmer Rouge, as I said, all the intellectuals, you wear glasses, you get killed just because for wearing glasses. But this new generation, they haven't even, were not even there. Sorry, the exact questions I forgot now, you know.
The question is about the future of Cambodia.
Oh, the elections, yes. Okay. Well, you see, he is recording my speech, so I better be careful. Now, you said there are many candidates within the party, you know, of CPP. Yes, Hun Sen has now become so powerful, he adds a few more titles, you know. Maha Senopati, which in Indonesia we have the same, you know, Maha Senopati. And he's maybe Indonesian also, I don't know. But so I personally, I cannot see that the people in his party, there may be rifts now. I know definitely, I don't want to mention names. But even Sok An, Hun Sen says, close down your cockfighting, because Sok An is the most powerful figure economically. He is the treasurer of Hun Sen, but he loves cockfighting, so Hun Sen. But I don't see that they will establish new party, you see? And if they don't establish new party, they will have to elect under CPP, because in Cambodia, the election is by party. Unlike in the U.S., you see, you elect people, like this Minnesota senator forever goes on, because you elect people. Because in Cambodia, the party elect. That means the party can really select anybody. They are the powerful one. We have in Indonesia the same, you see. The party, you elect the party, and then the party decides who should be there. So I don't see any rift there are dissenting voices. Sok An, maybe Sarkang, well, they have been saying that for a long time, Sarkang is now Minister of Interior, is in charge of provincial district managers. But Hun Sen is a good chess player, he always sees your move three times ahead of you. Mm. I hope it answers.
Yeah.
Here. Any other? Yes.
Yeah, about the future of the peacekeeping missions of the UN. You mentioned a lot about the Timor-Leste, and of course the UNAMED mission there was very flawed because the security arrangements were left in the hand of the Indonesian forces.
Yes.
And I don't know exactly what the arrangements were for security, what they were supposed to be in Cambodia, but you mentioned that you did not have adequate security. So based on your experience in Cambodia, and looking also at the UNAMED mission in Timor-Leste, what can you tell us about the future of similar peacekeeping forces, especially those that are watching over national referendums or goals?
Yeah. Okay. The peacekeeping can be successful only if the assumptions are correct. The assumption in Cambodia was that Khmer Rouge is a good guy, so we don't need security. You see, 15,000 troops were there not to provide security. If you have security, you need like Iraq, 145,000, 138,000. Now reduced by Obama to 115,000, If you want security, like the U.S. does in Iraq, you need that much. So 15,000 troops definitely was not for security, because once again, the U.N. believed its own lie that the Khmer Rouge is a good boy. So these 15,000 were there to demobilize the soldiers. They said, all four are good guys, because at the Jakarta cocktail party, they all shake hands and drink cocktail. So good guys, So 15,000 was not enough for security, because when Siem Reap was attacked, there were Vietnamese villages in Siem Reap. There's always animosity between Vietnam and Cambodia. And they killed, in my province of Siem Reap, the Khmer Rouge killed, 40 villagers, Vietnamese, just opened fire on them, But Hun Sen's government says, I'm not in charge of security. You said I should be demobilized. And UN have nobody there, because we didn't have enough. So the assumption is this correct. Well, it may not answer your question. Now, in East Timor, again, this happens. East Timor was Timor-Leste was after Indonesia, and it's the same guy in New York. It's my boss, Vendrell. I said, who is in charge of security? He says, the Indonesians, but that's crazy. Every time Habibie called, the president, Habibie is the president of Indonesia. Kofi Annan says, hey, we need more security. So Wiranto sent more troops. It's like the wolf is in the chicken coop, and then you send more wolves, so that may not answer your question, but this is the only problem, again, is that the UN is not a world government, you see. It consists of all these powers that are conflicting. Even today, as I said, in the case of Darfur, you see, The UN has established a peacekeeping force in Darfur, but the president of Darfur says, no way, you know, you cannot get in here. Coming back to Timor Leste, you see, when Indonesia keeps shooting this poor Timorese, you know, Kofi Annan called Habibie, you know, you must accept international troops. And because, you know, all this killing. So Indonesia still has to say yes before international troops came. And we cannot have peacekeeping troops at that time because it takes 6 months to establish a peacekeeping force. So who is ready to come in? Australians. Now, I was in the Indonesian embassy in New York, and Foreign Ali Alatas asked me, you know, what is the difference between peacekeeping and multinational? I said, multinational is not UN, but you better say yes for the Australians to come, you know. So, because Ali Alatas also get fed up with our military, you know. So Alatas says yes, so Habibie says yes, and the Australians came. But Kofi Annan had to beg Habibie. If Habibie said no, you cannot, they cannot come in, the Australians. And as I said, in Darfur, it's the same thing. The president cannot can say no, and you cannot do anything. So this is the question of national sovereignty. If you call me back next year, I will talk about humanitarian intervention. Yes, you had to. You mean you talk about 150,000 in Iraq, for instance?
Yeah, if you wanted the UN soldiers to establish security, you need that many. However, because they're not, you know, they're not Cambodians, they're not related to Cambodia in any way, they kind of divorced from the, and I was just thinking that they could possibly cause more problems than they solve.
Yeah, you are right. At lunchtime, actually, someone asked about the morality of these troops. And those of you who were there at lunch, you mentioned Bulgaria. They have sent their gangsters to East Timor, to Cambodia, because they just moved from communism to democracy in Bulgaria. So they sent two battalions of gangsters, you know, and they terrorized even the brothels. They said, I want that woman, and that's the wife of the owner, you see, so like that. And the Khmer Rouge, I mentioned about Khmer Rouge being moralizers, got very retaliated against the Bulgarian soldiers, and they killed some of their officers. So what you are saying is right, of course. Human beings, again, I talk at lunchtime, my boss Akashi is a Japanese, you know, and he says exactly what you said, you know, when someone criticized these UN soldiers going to these massage parlors, you know, he says, oh, what do you expect from young people, you know? Just tell them to park their car across the corner because he doesn't want. Oh, that made everybody of the NGOs very angry in Cambodia. But your point is, of course, right. Soldiers will be soldiers, you see. You cannot expect them to behave morally. I don't know whether that's a good question. Yes?
Sihanouk is really in the twilight of his years. He's extremely old and infirmed. Well, not infirmed, but he's very, you know, ill. It seems like his last move really is he's trying to pull the remaining royals out of the political scene and trying to create their own niche outside of the political sphere. He realizes, I think, that Hun Sen Bank is written off. Any kind of, you know, royalist political bomb is written off. Do you agree with that? Do you think he is trying to, maybe his one last final move is to get them apoliticized?
Oh, Sihanouk, you never know, you know, what he is doing next. You see, Sihanouk has dominated Cambodian politics since 1941, and in one way or the other. And he is a very wily fellow. You know, when he says to me, you know, the Khmer Rouge, Excellency, very happy. So he uses the Khmer Rouge even if he wants to screw Hun Sen, you see. Sorry. you know, if he wants to get rid of Hun Sen. So Hun Sen actually is the only one who managed to slice up Sihanouk, you know, slice by slice like a salami. And now, since you also compare Cambodia and Thailand, now Thaksin may want to do the same with the king of Thailand,
but he's trying.
But Hun Sen also has the money. Well, Thaksin has a lot of money, but Hun Sen has much more money than Sihanouk. The king of Thailand is, according to Forbes, the biggest, richest man among the kings. You know. So what Sihanouk is doing, as I said, unless he is dead and buried, you know, you never know what he is doing. But so far, Hun Sen has managed to slice up his power, slice by slice, you see. And then he even managed to get a man who is close to him, you know, to become king. Hun Sen and the queen, you know, conspired. They say, I want this Sihamoni to be king because he is a ballet dancer in Paris, so he doesn't care, you know, about governing. So the king reigns but does not rule. But, you know, so it's still, well, I used to think that the Thai king, you know, is a very good man. He plays saxophone and he doesn't interfere. But apparently, all these yellow shirts, they got food, you know, from the king. Well, the queen, maybe. Because I was in Bangkok and my office is past these yellow shirts. And I was given food, you know. I said, what is this for? Well, everyone gets food, you know. So that's where they always, well, but that's, yeah. That's I don't know whether the king still has anything like, but I agree, unless he is dead and buried, he still has some schemes. All the time he continued to scheme, you know. First against the Americans, he called it, Americans are, you know, imperialist, and he created the Khmer Rouge, and then he used the Khmer Rouge, and he got 18 children killed by the Khmer Rouge, you know. But he went to New York to plea for the Khmer Rouge. I told you, he was in this New York campaigning, you know, and singing and dancing to campaign for the Khmer Rouge.
But later in interviews, he always talks about how he was the prisoner of the Khmer Rouge, and how he would pass notes to people in New York saying, please help me, free me from the Khmer Rouge.
Yeah, no, that happened actually during this 1979, September, when he was flown by the Khmer Rouge to New York to plea, you know, please don't recognize this Vietnamese puppet Hun Sen, you know. So he was in the hotel, and he was, of course, guarded by the Khmer Rouge. But he slipped a note to the U.S. embassy, to the U.S. people. He says he wants asylum in the U.S. But the U.S. didn't want to do that, you know, because that's create too much trouble. So instead, they flew him to France. Yeah. Yes?
You are Indonesian, I was interested in knowing your position on the issue of tribunal and the justice. We are in East Timor now talking a lot about the justice in relation to the Indonesian military, not Indonesian people.
Yeah.
As a practitioner and also as an Indonesian citizen,
yeah.
What do you think about, in terms of Cambodia, what do you think the importance of the justice to the post-conflict society, what's the impact?
Yes.
And in the case of Indonesian military and as a former diplomat, what do you think your position on the
Well, justice? Yeah, the problem with that is, as I think somebody said, you said, you know, we cannot try Nixon and so on because unfortunately, we cannot try foreign countries or China for supporting the Khmer Rouge or Vietnam. And so in the case of Timor, you have very good truth and reconciliation. But the big culprits are across the border. Now you are independent, you see. So it's very difficult for an East Timorese court to try those Indonesians, you know.
But if there are some international
tribunal? Yes, yes. If there is an international tribunal, there is this tribunal that is ICC, International Criminal Court. As I said, Timor-Leste and Cambodia, both being ex-conflict country, are important members. But they are so slow, you know. It's very difficult for them to... Now the only one they have tried is, they have condemned, is the president of Sudan. He is officially condemned, you know. And anybody should arrest him. But he went to Egypt, you see, and nobody arrested him. So, as I said, the UN has no teeth, you know. And as I mentioned, humanitarian intervention is another thing. But this is the problem, that they cannot even arrest one man, you know, well, they arrested him, the ICC. So, and it's very difficult for them to be arresting Wiranto, difficult for political reason. First of all, you have all the evidence, you know. And even in Cambodia, you know, they should be actually also, well, as I said, the Cambodian thing was instead of being tried, they were recognized for 11 more years. But your question is quite correct. The only thing is that the UN moves very slowly, and the first time that now they, because now there is also a problem of the month or flavor of the month. You see, Sudan is now the problem. And so now everyone is Sudan, you know. That's because it's happening today, you see. The Cambodian trial is 30 years, and doesn't mean that, you know, these people should not be tried, you know. But actually East Timor could ask, for instance, ICC, because you are a member, you know. I remember a very important member. You should ask, why don't you try Wiranto, for instance, you see. But the process is so cumbersome, and there are pros and cons, and as I said, I was very surprised that they managed to indict this president of Sudan, which is a big thing. Of course, the first thing he did was kick out all the NGOs there from Sudan, you see.
I think you didn't ask my first question first, but my first question about how the importance of the tribunal, the justice process like that, in the healing of the wounds after long...
Okay. Yes, well, at lunchtime we talk 1.5 hours about the tribunal in Cambodia. And this gentleman, you know, so I didn't want to repeat. This gentleman, as a Cambodian, the new generation, thinks it is very important. Now, the problem with the Cambodian tribunal is it ran out of money because they say there is too much corruption. So the Western donors who are refusing to give more money, and they run out of money until this corruption charge is resolved. The corruption became very, very much. Basically, what it says is the Cambodian employees have to kick back 25% to 30% of their salary to a senior official of the Cambodian, you see. So because of that, there is but as gentlemen say, it's still very, very important because they are the younger generation. They were born after Cambodia, Khmer Rouge, but they still want this justice. But when I said at lunchtime is now, you know, as he says, the foreign prosecutor, Le Petit, wants 5 more to be tried. But my question is the timing, you see. Now just to try 5, now we are only on 1, Doge, you know, that is the chief of the prison, S21, is being tried. It takes so long, and they are all dying, you know. The other one is Ying Sari. He is sick, and all the time he gets the best hospital. You know, now in the case of East Timor-Leste, you know, I think the problem there, of course, is how can we achieve reconciliation with Indonesia, because if it is through a tribunal, as I said, you cannot try people outside your country, you know, not in a national tribunal. It can only be in the ICC. But what do you feel is a good process? Because in the case of Cambodia, they killed their own people, but here it involves another country, you know. What do you, as Timor-Leste resident, what do you think could satisfy you, you know, for a reconciliation with Indonesia? What is, in your opinion, that Indonesia should arrest these people, or what is your opinion, you know? Yeah.
Can I just interrupt for just a second?
Yeah.
We're almost 15 minutes over time.
Oh,
so
okay.
Why don't we just wrap?
Okay.
Okay.
I think we always make a defense that the reconciliation is involving the people, not involving the criminals, who are the killers. I think we with Indonesia, that
in terms of people, there is no problem. There are a lot of Indonesian people who are still staying in East Timor, and there are a lot of Timorese students who are studying in Indonesia. So in terms of people, there is no problem. But in terms of criminal, we always...
Yeah, so you actually do not rest until those military should be tried.
Yeah.
Yes, well, I agree with you. I agree with you, you see. But I don't know how this SBY, you know, our new president, so far he is more democratic than the others. But whether he is going to finally try those people. Yeah, sorry to... Yeah.
Yeah. Is there another presentation tomorrow?
No, we Indonesian dances, but I'm not a dancer. See, Hanuk already get mad at me for singing, let alone dance, you know. This is Khmer New Year. I can dance Khmer.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
This podcast is a production of the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii. The center's director is Professor Barbara Watson-Andaya. The associate director is Paul Rausch. The Brown Bag series is coordinated by Hua Lei, and the podcast series is produced by Christian Razukas. Your announcer is Nozia Azmi. This is a free service made possible by the center, the University of Hawaii, and the United States Department of Education. For more podcasts, videos, and information about Southeast Asia, visit our website at hawaii.edu/CSEAS.